start out with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Masters, guide us in our study. Show us the inner truth and lift us into thy presence, into thy consciousness, into the transformation that changes us for now and always. Amen. Well, last week we began with the introduction, and hopefully all of you, would you mind passing these up? Hopefully all of you have had a chance to listen to the talk from last time and to get the handout for your own work.
I think we need a pass or something.
You need a pass?
Site?
I think, Carla, did you send out something around that? Or if people ask you, and okay.
We'll check in.
Okay. Carla is really not a terrorist, but she has an allergy to cats, so she's doing her best to not get the effects. So the idea that scripture is a parable and that your life, you can look at it as a parable itself. So this is something that I wrote up about my life as a parable. I was born in the region of the Sun Dynasty area, Sunnyside, of a father working in the Vaishya caste, agriculturalists and traders. A tradition that had come from many ancestral generations before. Sunnyside was originally conceived of as a religious community. Blessed by the ashes of Agni, the god of fire, from Mount Tahoma, the mother of waters, a.k.a. Mount Rainier, the area was blessed with rich soil and later became an agricultural center. I was the third son of three children. The eldest son continued the family business. I had a calling for another destiny. Parallel to the coast of the Pacific, the peaceful ocean, runs the spine of mountains, the Cascades. San Diego, a place of zoo of animal nature, forms the base chakra along this spine. Los Angeles is the second chakra, the place of sensuality and love of pleasure and the film industry. Sacramento, the secular home of state government, is the third chakra of individual will. San Francisco, where a heart was left, is the fourth. Do you remember the song? Portland, a portal of wind up the Columbia River Basin, is the fifth, the windpipe and place of speech. Seattle, place of vision, is the sixth, and Vancouver, Lotus Land, is the seventh. If you don't know, Vancouver is also known as Lotus Land in Canada. I was called to Seattle, where I met my guru. The move over the mountains represented a radical new phase of my life as I left behind family tradition and the land-based living to seek a new vision of reality. As a truck driver, I traveled up and down the corridor of the Cascadian Spine along I-5. This cascade, or waterfall of energy, of going up and down this corridor while chanting the name of God was tantamount to the Kriya breath. As a sadhaka, a spiritual aspirant, forces gathered about me both positive and negative. My guru, Mother Hamilton, came as Krishna, a guiding light as I was yet in a darkened state. Dhritarashtra was dominant in my life, guided as I was by the sense mind. Yet the Ganga, as Kutastha Chaitanya, or Christ consciousness, was awakening itself within, beyond my own ability to understand. Pandu, pure discriminating intelligence, son of Ambalika, positive discriminating faculty, and sage Vyasa, discriminating power and the author of the Mahabharata, was being awakened in me by my Guru. While I recognized the light my Guru brought to me, I struggled to integrate this truth into my mind, body, and behavior. This body, my Kurukshetra, or field of action, witnessed the back and forth, up and down battles of the positive and negative forces, the Pandus and the Kurus. Arjuna, my will aligned with divine will, was sometimes strong and clear, and at other times my Arjuna wanted to retreat from the field of battle and let the Kurus have their way. The entry of Draupadi, the Kundalini force and wife of the Pandus, accelerated this battle. The Kurus forced the Pandus into the jungle in hiding and tried to disrobe Draupadi, both shaming her and with a desire to dissipate her with lust, anger, and dominance. Draupadi appealed to Krishna, and she was saved from being disgraced in this way. Lust comes to dominate the sadhaka, but when the attention and prayers go to God, the attempt to reduce Draupadi, the Kundalini, to nothing, and tries to destroy the Pandus by the downward forces, they do not succeed. Thus, complete and total reliance upon God is engendered. The pure vibrational forces of the Pandu brothers, the first to the fifth chakras, are awakened. Draupadi is keen to see the destruction of the Kurus and allies herself through love to all the five Pandus, the five chakras. The Pandus then align themselves with Krishna, the Ajna at the point between the eyebrows. Ultimately, in the battle, even the noble Bhishma, the universal ego, the expanded self that has but a thin veil between itself and the absolute universal consciousness, or Shatanu, must give up its life voluntarily. Bhishma dies on a bed of arrows in the form of a cross. As the Gita unfolds, Krishna grants a vision to Arjuna that none else can see. During this revelation, Arjuna has a glimpse of the universal vision, not usually experienced by the lower chakras. No man has ever seen God. But it comes so that the ego nature can be inspired by the truth and profundity of this vision. This vision does not permanently establish the self in divine consciousness, so Arjuna must still carry on his duty and defeat the Kurus, the negative forces. There can be a false sense of mastery when this vision is granted, so the ego self must be dedicated to going all the way to the full and complete mastery, attained through the winning of the war. All of these states I have described I have experienced. The struggle can be long and arduous. There is no getting around this. Only those who have been through this battle may transcend ego consciousness and be established in divine consciousness. The Gita is a handbook intended to point the way to the five lower chakras representing the Son of Man. Only those who take the attitude of the Pandus may ascend this ladder of consciousness in the spine and brain. Only those who know the spirit of Sahadeva, Nakula, Arjuna, Bhima, Yudhisthira, is granted the guidance of Krishna, may come into this kingdom of heaven, a heaven that is right within you. So that is my parable. And it's interesting to look at your life as a parable. For instance, making a move from one place to another can symbolize a change in consciousness. That's the time that something shifts inside of you and new qualities come out. It can be positive or it can be negative. You can identify when new people come into your life or when people exit out of your life. And that can also be very symbolic of transitions in consciousness. So you begin to step back and you can look at your life in that way, not just in a kind of personalized way, but in a more depersonal, impersonal way, and see the energies and consciousness and the players from that standpoint. And I think when you do that, it helps put you in touch with your own journey You know, what is your life all about? And how is it that you find fulfillment eventually? And what are those things that help you along the way? And what are those things that hurt you along the way? And so it helps you to be more conscious of those choices, both those choices and those influences when people come and go. So, any thoughts or comments about that?
Yeah, I was doing mine, and I literally came up like against a real wall up to a certain age. I'm just going, okay, and it was all very clear, even things that had just bothered me tremendously my whole life, and it was like very dispassionate seeing it, and then I just could not go past a certain age. I just couldn't, like, okay, I'll just let it come when it comes.
Right,
but it was so weird. Just
Right. Do you have a sense of what that blockage, I mean, you don't have to go into detail, but just what's on the other side of that resistance?
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, not clear, but it has something to do with my innocence.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
The wrong side, though. But
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. So.
But an old pattern. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. Good. Anybody else do some work around seeing their life as a parable? Any discoveries or thoughts? Or?
I was surprised how, particularly it was 2005, it started with my trip to India with you, and ended moving to Bellingham, how full a year that was. And I, you know, if somebody would have told me before I did this, you know, 2005 was a big year in your life, and like, yeah, something's happened, but it wasn't happening.
Right,
but
right.
And when I kind of put it all together as a timeline, it was like, wow.
Lots happened, and significant pieces.
There was that pattern that often things happen all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see it at the time, but when you look back, there's jumps rather than it's all an even, slow
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. And Bellingham was significant for me as well because I lived here for a year, a little bit less. And when I did, that was the beginning of the Kundalini as with the meditation group that was here. And that was the first eruption. And it was a violent eruption, but it was the first eruption of the Kundalini inside of me. Yeah. Anybody else?
I had a hard time kind of getting started and trying to figure out a process. First thing that came to me was kind of a timeline,
mm-hmm.
and it was interesting because what it naturally wanted to do was going toward God, and it wasn't going away from God, it was going sideways.
Mm-hmm.
It was the natural thing that I kind of wanted to do, and then
stair steps.
Yeah, and then when I challenged it a little bit, it's like, or is it circling away from God? So it was kind of, but it was all. It was all the journey towards God. Just the markers that came up. It wasn't, embarrassingly enough, things like getting married and things like that. It was meeting David. It was meeting the first God-realized person that I remember, you know, that I knew something. This person had something. I didn't know what it was
right.
until later. But those things, it was all these punctuated
mm-hmm.
and then things that pulled me off of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So a real spiritual journey is what stood out to you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that the other things weren't important or significant along the way, but in relationship to how you're thinking about it. Mm-hmm. That's what stood out. Mm-hmm. Good. Good.
Yeah, for me it was the things that when he talks in the first chapter about the opposing forces that come.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have all of them, but there are some that stand out in your life. And when I look back from childhood up to even adulthood, they're the same things.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, they change, of course, with your maturity, but it's a lot of the same thing. And I found that just kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and then just as you're talking, I was just thinking about the meeting of Krishna when you talked about that mother.
Mm-hmm.
And my coming up to meet mother was just because of a lot of really bad choices, what looked like really bad choices I made, that I met certain people, and because of knowing them, it all evolved where I went from one side of the country to the other to meet my guru.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
It's just
how the guru can work through inscrutable means.
Yeah, just any one of those choices, if I had decided to do something different, wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, but it just all fit like a puzzle, just perfectly.
Mm.
Although looking back, somebody looking from the outside would have said they were very bad.
Right. Choices. Right. And I think that's one of the values of seeing your life from that perspective of a parable or as a story is. When those pieces click together, and before they seem disparate or happen chance or other kinds of things, and suddenly, wow, that just all, like a puzzle, all those pieces start fitting together. And I think the other thing that occurred to me as you were talking was that different people can play the same role in our life at different times. So somebody earlier in our life can play the role of Duryodhana, you know, the evil cousin. And at another time, it can be somebody else, you know, and that there's different times when just fill in that person, but it doesn't really make any difference. It's Duryodhana, or, you know, that's Dhritarashtra, that's the blind sense mind that's influencing us at that time. And so it helps us to depersonalize things, which I think gives us a better perspective on our life too. It's not about that person. That person was playing a role
mm-hmm.
in our life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Great.
I have a question because
mm-hmm.
I'm here, so I was
right.
trying to sort of take it out from the recording. Of course, I wasn't there to ask questions.
Right.
So I wasn't sure how I was trying to think about, for instance, struggling with a lack of confidence, for instance. I didn't know how to sort of fit that into the story or
mm-hmm.
even, I didn't know how to think about it actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's been a theme that's come up. Thinking
right.
I can't do something.
Right.
Then trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So how could you help me think about that in a different way?
Well, they're not all explicitly, all the Yogananda doesn't explicitly lay out all the different pieces. For instance, Duryodhana is built with, it comes with 100 siblings. And each one of them represents a negative aspect of ourselves. Now, Duryodhana is himself unsure of himself. But how he tries to deal with that is he agitates for a fight. He wants this battle because he's insecure, because he's unsure of himself. And he wants to test himself. He wants to prove for himself to remove that fear. He thinks that if he wins the battle, that the fear will be removed, and then he'll feel more whole and more complete. Which is a fallacy, of course, but it's his idea of how to compensate for that. So that's his way of dealing with it. Arjuna, for instance, isn't necessarily lacking in confidence, but his will to fight completely, he's like a balloon that completely deflates. He's got nothing in him. He goes limp. He falls onto the ground. He's enthusiastic, he knows what he's there for, and suddenly he's gone. I don't want to fight, I can't fight, I don't even have the ability to fight. And really what the whole Gita is Krishna kind of reinflating him again with wisdom and why you're here and why you must enter into the field. And so that's another aspect, though, of withdrawing from the field. So not every piece is all kind of named out for us, but we can just know that within those 100 brothers, you know, there's one that fits in, that fits in there, that is part of that, that defeats us, that makes us feel weak, that undermines what we're trying to do. By looking at these positive and negative forces that are inside of us, it also helps to explain why we're our own worst enemies. Why we set out the positive inside, sets out to do something, and that negative oppositional force rises up to meet us. And it's a real battle, and we just go, what is wrong with me? You know, I want to lose weight, but I eat an extra piece of pie afterwards, after I eat dinner. You know, why do I have these mutually contradictory kinds of forces that are working on me here? I want to meditate, and yet I just can't for the life of me sit down and do it. I start feeling anxious and agitated, and I just want to be anywhere else but sitting and meditating. So we have these dual forces in us, and this is a huge battle, and that's one thing to acknowledge here. We oftentimes feel like, I've got to be the worst spiritual aspirant in the world, and nobody can be as bad as me, and I'm weak, and I'm undecided, and all of these things are going on inside of me. And this story lays it out and says, these are universal themes. Join the human race. You know, this is what it is. This is what it's being on the field. So that's, you know, we draw all of those lessons from it.
So the part of you, or part of me that wants to, has some courage or something, I want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I may be, again, being too literal, but what does that conform to in the story?
Well, of course, you have these positive uplifting forces, and in a general sense, if you do have the book by Yogananda. Oh, okay. Well, that's the missing piece then. There's a huge amount of information in the introduction. And there's a genealogy chart here that Yogananda then explains the different characters and what they mean. So if you go about halfway down the page, the Pandus are on the right-hand side. They represent the positive force, the right-hand side there. They represent the positive forces that are taking you back to God. And then Dhrishtarashtra, he represents the ego mind, and he's the blind king. And then from him comes Duryodhana, who is the son, and he represents that ego nature and then all of his brothers that come with it. So when you do get the book, you'll be able to read down through here, and a lot of these characteristics we find inside of us are all laid out here. But those are the two primary kinds of oppositional forces that we find. And they're the ones who are embattled here within the story.
But I certainly heard it in the recording, but I didn't quite know.
It really helps to go through it, and not just once. This is packed with information. So to go through it and just, first of all, the first time you read it, just let it wash over you. You know, don't try to get every detail. Just let it kind of wash through. Get the general concepts and the general ideas. And then as you work with the material, things will begin to become more clear to you as you work with it. But I would say this description here is not a once-through read. No, this is...
Yeah, when I listened to the recording more than once, because the first time I was trying to do the dishes for the lesson, and I couldn't...
Right. So there's a lot of information here, and it's not necessary you go through and memorize the whole thing, but start getting a sense of these forces and how they apply to you. Yeah, good. Yeah, that'll be a huge help, though. Okay. Your life is a parable. Any other thoughts? Anybody have difficulty with it? Aha, okay.
I did have a hard time just getting started. What I did was I just sort of put down points of what some events that had happened in my life.
Yes.
And that's about where I got to, was just writing down all the points. What it came out was I was sort of going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Going good, and then another event would happen and I'd go down.
Okay.
So a lot of going back and forth.
So can you identify that then in terms of being on the field? Kurukshetra means the field, which is in our case, it's the body and the mind that's identified with the body. And that there are positive forces, and these forces are at war with each other, right? And within the story, the Pandus don't win every day. Some days they lose, and they lose badly. And they're pretty beat up over it. So sometimes, and they're outnumbered. They have seven armies, which represents seven chakras. The Kurus have 10 armies, which represents the 10 qualities of the mind. It's the five senses. So it's both the input that we get from the senses plus how that is received in the brain. So that's five and five. Five senses feeding into the brain, and how the brain interprets those five senses. That's the 10 qualities of the mind. So that's contending with our desire to do what's right, to try to lead a better life. And meanwhile, we're getting assaulted by these other forces. And so that's it. That's the story that you're describing right there. And it's being pulled back and forth. And some days you win in terms of the uplifting, and some days you lose. And sometimes very badly, you really blow it. And so when you can see it, that these are universal, they're true for all people, that Jesus, that Buddha, that Krishna, that Master, that Mother, Sri Yukteswar, I mean, everybody at some point in their evolution from the human to the divine, they all contended with these things. And they didn't always win. What they did, at least in their lives of attaining complete realization, is they never gave up. And they remained absolutely determined to achieve their goal. Master used to say, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. So there's hope for us. Yes. Right. Yes. And Master talks a lot about habits and how powerful they are. And once we form a habit, it's really a force to contend with. So we need to be careful what habits we cultivate. And that we're always cultivating good habits. We can't be haphazard or kind of say, well, that's not such a bad habit, you know. I'll just let that one kind of ride. We'll pay a price if we do that. So Drona is the martial arts trainer. He's the one who's training them how to fight, how to kind of move forward. He's that projective force. And so he's very important in terms of guiding good habits. And he's essentially a good guy. A good guy. There's an interesting part of the story, though. He's a Brahmin. He was born a Brahmin. But he took up the life of a Kshatriya, which means he's a warrior. And it was really the wrong decision for him to make. And that's one reason why in the battle he has to die. Meaning, the inner meaning is, he was intended to be divinized, spiritualized. But he chose to enter into the world to compete, to win, to learn how to gain victory. That's the Kshatriya. And so he went against his inborn nature. So he had to be transcended. And he's one of the ones, he's the good guys, but he had to be transcended. Bhishma is the other one. Bhishma is the universal ego. And that is closely attuned to the Christ self. And he too, and he can only die if he voluntarily, if he willingly gives up his life. Nobody can take his life from him. So he's a very Christ-like figure in that he surrenders himself and he voluntarily dies within the battle. And when he does that, he's shot full of arrows and he lays on this bed of arrows. He's laying down and all these arrows in his back are all supporting him and he's laid out in the form of a cross. So thousands of years before he was the original Christ, he was the crucified one. And he's the one who has a very thin veil. It's when you're very uplifted in consciousness, but you still have a sense of I and mine and me. And that has to go. That has to dissolve completely. Very, very subtle. So he's a very good guy, but he ends up on the Karu side, the negative side, because ultimately he has to be transcended.
But he has to surrender.
But he has to surrender, right? His life cannot be taken from him. He can only give it up voluntarily. Which is the same story as Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. He surrenders. He gives up his life. See, these are universal themes that get played out in all the major world religions. And maybe no more dramatically or picturesquely than in the Christian and in the Hindu traditions. So I think you didn't have as much trouble with it as you thought.
One nice literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something that you can keep working with a bit. And just because it takes a stepping back, not identifying so much, oh, that's me. That's me not doing the right thing. That's me making the wrong choice. That's me. See, that's where we're so close to it. And when we can step back from it and see it as an allegorical story, there's more distance between myself and the story. And that frees me from the story somewhat. And then if I can bring it into real time and say, oh, this person in my life represents this, and this person represents that, and choices that I make look like this and have these kinds, it's all part of the allegory, suddenly I can see it with a new perspective. It's a bit more like I'm flying high like an eagle and I can look down on my own life rather than being so closely identified with it and feeling so bad when I make the wrong decision and so proud of myself when I make the right one. It's like, oh, that's the story unfolding. That's the power of the parable. And we see our life in universal themes. So it connects us with all people at all times. And that's somewhat comforting. Oh, it's not just me. I mean, people have been writing about this for thousands of years because it's powerful and it's true and it's universal.
Failure to meditate, resisting meditation, putting off meditation.
Okay.
It's like, oh, get into your meditation. What a significant one.
And as much as it's that restless nature, it just will not let us settle down. And they're always instigating. They're always in there. They're always trying to destroy the Pandus, too. They try to burn down their house. They try to kill them. They try to play tricks on them. They're always agitating. Always agitating. You think they're not very nice. And they're right inside of me.
Well, the experience I had was more like with Sanjay.
Mm-hmm. Who is... he is the observer. He's a dispassionate observer. He's also intuitive. He's seeing the battlefield from a great distance. and then portraying that to Dhritarashtra, the blind king, who is the sense mind, the manas. Okay? And so identifying with Sanjay?
Yeah, and seeing how, like, if something happens and that stepping back, and then seeing the two sides of myself, one side saying, this is a problem, it's okay, you can work it out, and the other side just like, oh, here I go again, what is the problem here, what's wrong with me? Why is this making me so upset?
Right.
So seeing the battle between the two, but being able, and seeing how much easier it was to step back.
Right.
And see the two, two parts of myself arguing with each other.
Right. Right. Yeah, and you're jumping ahead. That's okay. That's okay. But yes, that's recognizing and acknowledging Sanjay, and we're going to be talking more about him tonight because he's really an essential character here.
I had Duryodhana come up.
He's a nasty little fellow, isn't he? When you were able to see them then as a character within the parable, you identified them with as Duryodhana, did you notice that your relationship then to that memory and to that experience, did it change? Did it shift then? What did you notice?
In a cartoon.
Uh-huh.
And even a lot of us in the class were like, you've got to be kidding.
Sounds like Yosemite Sam.
Something like that. You wore cowboy boots, but people didn't wear cowboy boots in where we live. And
right.
We were like, and you would say, is the homework due Friday? And he'd go, you bet your boots. And we'd be like, okay, whatever. because we were in eighth grade, and we were like,
uh-huh.
You're weird. Why don't you go back to Texas? We really don't like you here.
So how did he then become Duryodhana?
Well, with this incident, with this he was always kind of bullied. He was just, his whole personality was bluff and bravado.
Right. That's definitely Duryodhana.
Intimidating people.
Mm-hmm.
But this one incident,
mm-hmm.
And I, got in trouble, but I was protected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. So your Arjuna came out.
Yeah.
So again, as you see that as characters versus just memories and this person was irritating or they were out of place or they were a bully, when you began to see them as characters out of a parable, did you notice that changed your relationship with them?
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, it depersonalized it, and
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And you can see him, as Lorraine said, you can see that same thing kind of show up again and again.
And it's interesting because in some situations, like in that situation, I stood up to him. But then in other situations, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting to see where I didn't and where I did.
So in taking that parable then, one of the things you may like to do is then see, okay, how can Arjuna show up more often? And what would that look like? And how would that feel? And Arjuna aligned with Krishna. And then how does that feel? I think one of the qualities of depersonalizing a situation is we normally will see the emotional charge begins to get neutralized. And we just don't feel the same emotional charge. We don't feel as hurt. We don't feel as self-righteous. We don't feel as involved in it, in the drama, as we have before. It helps us to take a step back from it all. And that's one of the positive things that can happen.
In the past, I've been upset that my parents didn't ever ask me what my side of the story was. They just, you know, I got in trouble. They were called and all this stuff. You know, they were teachers.
Right. So when you see it as part of a parable, then what do you notice how that...
Doesn't
have that same thing. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
There was one thing that reading this and kind of connecting, it really helped me understand some of the things in the Bible that weren't making sense.
Uh-huh.
And so it was like, I think it's Corinthians or something, basically says, God isn't going to give up. He's going to keep teaching you the same lesson over and over and over. And it's like, yeah, thanks. But when you put it, these two together,
mm-hmm.
it's like, okay, so you have your fights, you have your fights, and it's great because the fights are going to get easier with that certain subject,
mm-hmm.
you know, and God's doing it for your own good. He's going to perfect
right.
you. He's going to sand you until it's a double lot, you know, or a triple lot sandpaper
right.
or whatever, you know. It's like, okay, it might be hard and everything, but it's, and so, and for me, connecting it to the Bible really.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of for some reason to live
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And I think this idea of depersonalizing, for the other person, it removes the emotional charge. But for ourselves, if it's say, I'd like to manifest more of Arjuna, that strong, determined will. And by making that an impersonal force, it allows me to bring that forward more fully than if I think, you know, I'm kind of weak-willed and kind of washy and mushy around the, you know, I don't seem to have that. No, okay, how can I manifest more Arjuna? And now when I depersonalize it like that, it allows me to get stronger.
Yeah, because you don't have to come up with it.
Right.
You have to let it flow through you.
Right.
I didn't have the book till today, but one of the things as I was thinking about my life that came to me about, I sort of saw my life before as in darkness. I wasn't on a spiritual journey really, and then I started searching. But as I looked at it, I realized that there was always that positive force wanting to make a better
yes.
life. And I saw that as God, and I saw.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in that it was good for me to see I could sort of not. Beat myself up so badly for
right.
that part of my life too, and to see the progress and too that you know, it was all I had to get here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had to get to that place where so I was progressing as I
mm-hmm.
think, even going into those dark places. I still progressed to get where to meet you. Yeah, so I was able to somehow look at it that way instead of looking at it like I just messed up that whole part of my life.
Right.
And
we can see that battle of light and darkness all the way through. And it can come in my parents, for instance, who have not had a strong spiritual drive in this lifetime. But my father, for instance, had a very strong drive to do business. He had his own business, to do it in a way that was dharmic. He had a strong sense of right and wrong. He had a strong sense for truth. He had a strong sense for not lying, not stealing, not cheating. Those were things that he cultivated and that he valued a lot. And so while you may not look at it and say, well, those are that's specifically a spiritual path, and in his way it is, because that's what he came to learn and that's what he came to really solidify. And of course all of those things will do him very well, stand him very well when he is called to a more conscious kind of evolution. So in our lives, as we look back on it, what before may not have seemed like an overtly spiritual kind of choice, yet there was a choice between higher and lower, of beautiful or ugly, of, you know, reaching out for something greater or kind of holding back and not doing that. And so it counts in a lot of different ways that we can now see as that's part of the spiritual journey.
Yeah, that's what I got.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a spiritual journey,
right.
Still. It wasn't separate, though.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's part of the value of seeing these positive, negative forces working in our life. It works in every aspect of our life. Every aspect. And there's nothing that's devoid of it. That's the good news and the bad news. Because we're now accountable for every part. But the good news is then that spiritualizing all of our life is now possible, whatever level it's on. Great. Well, good work. Good work. Good beginning. So, now we go on to the first chapter.
I do like having put the despondency of Arjuna first.
It's where it starts. It's where the story starts. So what I'm going to do is you can read along or you can just listen and kind of take it in. Starting with page 4. And I'm not going to read any of the commentary. I'm just going to read straight through, because actually even without the commentary, the Gita reads quite beautiful. It's a very interesting story from very beginning. So you can read along with it or you can just take it in. It begins with Dhritarashtra, who is the blind king. On the holy plain of Kurukshetra, when my offspring and the sons of Pandu had gathered together, eager for battle, what did they, O Sanjay? Master has a long commentary, so I'm going to have to... And as I say, much information in all of this. And... Let's see. And then we go to page 48. Sanjay said, King Duryodhana, after having seen the armies of the Pandavas, and the Pandavas, you'll remember, are light or white. They represent the guys in the white hats. The Pandavas in battle array repaired to his preceptor, Drona, and spoke as follows. O teacher, behold this great army of Pandu, arranged in battle order by the talented disciple, the son of Draupada. Here present are mighty heroes, extraordinary bowmen, as skillful in battle as Bhima and Arjuna, the veteran warriors Yoyadana, Bharata, and Draupada, the powerful Dhritarashtra, Chitadwa, I'm not going to guarantee my pronunciation on any of these, Kasharaja, eminent among men, Purujit, Kuntajoha, and Shabaya, the strong Yodamaya, the valiant Yodamanja, the sons of Sahadra, and the sons of Draupadi, all great lords of chariots. So internally, these are talking about the positive forces that are arrayed against Duryodhana. And Drona is both of their teachers. but he's taken the side with Duryodhana. Listen to, O flower of the twice-born, best of Brahmins, about the generals of my army, who are prominent amongst ourselves. These I speak about for thine information. And then he goes on to listen to list. The warriors are thyself, Drona, Bhishma, Karua, Kripa, victors in battle. And then he goes on to name some more. And Master talks about which many of these individuals represent. And numerous other warriors, all well trained for battle and armed with various weapons, are present here, ready for my sake to lay down their lives. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to read from this other Gita because it'll be less page turning that way. I think we'll go a bit smoother. This army of ours, fully protected by Bhishma, is unconquerable, while their army of theirs, guarded in every way by Bhima, is easy to conquer. Therefore, stationed in your respective positions on all fronts, do you all guard Bhishma in particular on all sides. The grand old man of the Kurava race, their glorious grand uncle Bhishma, cheering up Duryodhana, roared terribly like a lion and blew his conch. And one thing to remember here is that these conches represent vibration. And so when they blow their, each one has a conch cell that's tuned to their personality, and it represents the vibration of their consciousness. Then conches, kettle drums, tabors, drums, and trumpets suddenly blared forth, and the noise was tumultuous. So you can see these two huge armies numbering in the millions of people on each side. Then seated in a glorious chariot drawn by white horses, Sri Krishna, as well as Arjuna, blew their celestial conches. Sri Krishna blew his conch named Patyacharya, Arjuna his own called Devadatta, and while Bhima of terrible deeds blew his mighty conch Pandra. King Yudhisthira, son of Kunti, blew his conch Anantajaya, while Nakula and Sahadeva blew theirs known as Sugosa and Manipuksha, respectively. And the excellent archer, the king of Kasha, and Saki, and he goes on to name about others who are also blowing their conch shells. And the terrible sound echoing through heaven and earth rent the hearts of Dhritarashtra's sons. Now, O the Lord of the earth, seeing your sons arrayed against him, and when missiles were ready to be hurled, Arjuna, son of Pandu, took up his bow and then addressed the following words to Sri Krishna. Krishna, place my chariot between the two armies and keep it there till I have carefully observed these warriors drawn up for battle and have seen with whom I have engaged in this fight. I shall scan the well-wishers in the war of evil-minded Duryodhana, whoever has assembled on their side are ready for the fight. Sanjay said, O King, thus addressed by Arjuna, Sri Krishna placed the magnificent chariot between the two armies in front of Bhishma, Drona, and all the kings, and said, Arjuna, behold these Kauravas assembled here. Now Arjuna saw stationed there at both the armies his uncles, granduncles, and teachers, even great-granduncles, maternal uncles, brothers and cousins, sons and nephews, and grandnephews, even so friends, fathers-in-law, and well-wishers as well. So you can imagine coming to this army, and you're looking on the other side, these people you're going to have to engage with, and you see people you know, you love, and you respect. Seeing all of these relations present there, Arjuna was filled with deep compassion and uttered these words in sadness. Arjuna said, "Krishna, at the sight of these kinsmen arrayed for battle, my limbs give way, and my mouth is parching. Nay, a shiver runs through my body, and hair stands upright. The bow, Gandava, slips from my hand, and my skin, too, burns all over. My mind is whirling, as it were, and I can stand no longer. And Kesava, I see such omens of evil, nor do I see any good in killing my kinsmen in battle. Krishna, I do not covet victory, nor kingdom, nor pleasures. Govinda, of what use will kingdom, or luxuries, or even life be to us?" Those very persons for whose sake we covet the throne, luxuries, and pleasures, teachers, uncles, sons, and nephews, and even so granduncles and great-granduncles, maternal uncles, fathers-in-law, grandnephews, brothers-in-law, and other relations, are here arrayed on the battlefield, risking their lives and wealth. O slayer of Madhu, I do not want to kill them, though they should slay me, even for the throne of the three worlds, how much less for earthly lordship. Krishna, how can we hope to be happy, slaying the sons of Dhritarashtra? By killing these desperados, sin will surely take hold of us. Therefore, Krishna, it does not behoove us to kill our relations, the sons of Dhritarashtra. For how can we be happy after killing our own kinsmen? Even if these people, with minds blinded by greed, perceive no evil in destroying their own race and no sin in treason to friends, why should not we, O Krishna, who see clearly the sin accruing from the destruction of one's family, think of turning away from this crime? Age-long family traditions disappear with the destruction of a family, and virtue having been lost, vice takes hold of the entire race. With the preponderance of vice, Krishna, the women of the family become corrupt, and with the corruption of women, the descendant of Vrishni, there ensues a mixture of castes. Admixture of bloods damns the destroyers of the race, as well as the race itself. Deprived of the offspring of rice and water, the manes of their race shall also fall. So in this case, and as Krishna says, caste is determined by not what family you're born into, but by your own virtues. So he's saying that if things get off course here, people lose their way. They aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, what they're born to be doing. And more confusion comes about as a result. Even if these people, with minds blinded by greed, perceive no evil in destroying their own race and no sin in treason to friends, why should we, O Krishna, who see clearly the sin accruing from the destruction of one's family, think of turning away from this crime? I think I read that already. With the preponderance of vice, Krishna, admixture, okay, I've read all of that, sorry. Through these evils hanging about an intermixture of castes, the age-long caste traditions and family customs, the killers of kinsmen get extinct. Krishna, we bear that men who have lost their family traditions dwell in hell for an indefinite period of time. What a pity, though possessed of intelligence, we should set our mind on the commission of a great sin, that due to the lust for throne and enjoyment, we are intent on killing our own kinsmen. It would be better for me if the sons of Dhritarashtra, armed with weapons, killed me in battle while I was unarmed and unresisting. Sanjay said, Arjuna, whose mind was agitated by grief on the battlefield, having spoken thus and having thrown aside his bow and arrows, sank into the hinder part of his chariot. The end of chapter one. It starts on an upper note, doesn't it? It is the dilemma of the human condition that we withdraw, that we don't want to enter into the battle. And in this case, Arjuna is making up all kinds of good reasons why he should withdraw from it. Krishna then is going to make his case for why he should continue to engage in it. So there's a couple of themes that come from this first chapter then. One is an identification of who's on whose side here. There's different virtues that are coming, and as you kind of read through this, you'll get a fuller meaning from Yogananda on what these various people represent as they're being named on each side of the battlefield. But the main dynamic comes with Arjuna. He has to be brought out into the center of the field between these two vast armies. They've just both had a moment of blowing their conch shells and their kettle drums. First Duryodhana and the Kurus on one side, and then Arjuna and his side on the other. So the setting is there for these two great armies. But there's even something that's very fundamental to the beginning of the first chapter, and that is the character of Sanjay. Sanjay has this ability to perceive what exactly is going on the battlefield. Internally, that is the observer inside of us. It's the dispassionate observer. He doesn't take sides. He's able to describe both sides accurately. He's able to talk about what's going on between these two armies in connection with these forces coming together. And that ability is absolutely essential for anybody who's trying to gain any sense of personal or spiritual growth. Your ability to observe your own experience. If you have no ability to observe your own experience, you will project out onto the world. I wouldn't have gotten angry except that person cut me off when we were going down the freeway. Therefore, I really had no choice but to pull out my gun and shoot at them. You know, because they cut me off, you know. I mean, isn't that obvious? They did that, you know. So you project out, and there's no sense of responsibility. There's no sense of what your participation is there. In the most extreme case of that, it would be a sociopathic personality, that it's just everything is projected out there. There's no sense of responsibility that is taken on by the individual. That's the extreme form of it. The other kind of end of that continuum is somebody who takes everything in as their fault. Well, of course, you know, that person was upset because, you know, I didn't do one certain thing right. So, of course, they had a right to beat me almost to death. That would be on the other side of the extreme. So on either one of those extremes, either taking no responsibility or being overly responsible for what everybody else does, there's no sense of the observer. There's no sense of stepping back and seeing life playing itself out. What's my part? What's somebody else's part? How does that all add up? Sanjay has that perfect ability to be able to describe exactly what's going on without taking any sides. He may have personal feelings and views about it, but he doesn't let it interfere with his ability to see that. So this ability to be able to be an impartial observer, I think, is so important to our personal and our spiritual growth that it's really the emphasis that I would like to put on for this first chapter. Now, of course, there's other places. It's that And I would say the other main dynamic after that one then is the sense of wanting to withdraw from the field, you know, and we've all had it, you know, excuse me, you know, isn't this the wrong life? You know, I was meant to have like a multimillionaire's life where I have lots of, you know, servants and everything comes to me just so easy. And isn't that the life I was supposed to have? You know, what's happened here? How come it's not so easy? So this feeling of, life is too hard. It shouldn't be this way. I don't want to engage with this. Yes, what this person is doing is wrong, but why should I have to do anything about that? And so we want to step back. We want to, or I don't know, you know, I always seem like I do the wrong thing and I make the wrong choices. What can I do about that? Well, actually, there's a lot you can do about it. But the sense is, I don't want to do anything about it. It's too hard. You know, I don't want to take responsibility. It's much easier to see myself as being helpless and hopeless. It's everybody else's fault. And as I say, the opposite end of that is being overly responsible and getting so engaged in everybody else's stuff and taking responsibility for what they think and what they feel and what they do, is you have no sense of yourself in there. You're just automatically drawn into situations, and then you overfunction and you wear yourself out. And then very often we get resentful about other people because they're not doing their part. So this ability to be Sanjay, to step back, in addition to, and what it leads to, is the idea of wanting to withdraw. The idea of, I don't want to engage in this battle. I just want to be left alone in peace, if you don't mind. I would just like to go to a cave someplace and meditate. I'm tired of the fight. I'm tired of the bickering. Tired of the differences. And I want to check out. And who of us have not had moments of that? You know, we all have. So we've all had this moment of Arjuna. Now, Arjuna goes into such great degree, you could say he's having an emotional breakdown. I mean, he's trained as a warrior all of his life. He completely loses it. He completely loses it. This is no small crisis that he's entered into here. This is a major, major thing for him. And here he is. I mean, that's the moment has come. This is what he's come for. And he wants to check out. So what I would like is for each month is for us to take a theme out of one of these themes within. And I will read you Papa's take, and he and the Gita Sandesh, he takes each chapter and he gives us a thumbnail sketch of what the theme is for that. So Papa's is, the Bhagavad Gita holds forth before mankind the highest and the loftiest ideal by attaining which the soul is liberated from all limitations and enjoys the peace and bliss of its inherent state of immortality. The first discourse of the Gita speaks of the one great obstacle that confronts the struggling soul in his effort to realize this blessed state of supreme freedom. Now, what is that malady that has possessed the soul, which has made his life cramped, narrow, and limited, bringing it a sense of helplessness and oftentimes utter despair? It is moha, or attachment, arising from the individual sense of I in relation to the body, and therefrom to the bodies of those near and dear to him by ties of blood or friendship or material obligations. This moha causes the mind of man, as a result of its narrow vision, to move in a limited circle, identifying itself with the interests of this circle. In this condition, the vision of man, starting from the individual center, radiates only within this circle and gets so much absorbed in it that the humanity and the world outside it are considered entirely separate and foreign to it. It is within the experience of every human being who has spent some thought on the mysteries of life that life lived in this limited vision is constant source of fear and sorrow. He further knows that the more is this vision expanded, the greater is his freedom and the higher is his joy. He feels that he is imprisoned within the fortressed walls raised around him by his own ego, and although he knows that his freedom lies in breaking down these walls, his attempts at such a task prove futile, as he is conscious that moha has enfeebled him and made him unequal to it. It is this moha that weakened the strong, altruistic purpose which fired the bosom of Arjuna to stand up and fight on the battlefield. Similarly, it is this moha that arrests the march of the aspiring soul when he strives for a wider vision of life and the resultant action. Man gets through moha so helplessly entangled and caught in the grip of selfishness, greed, and lust, thus acting and living solely for himself and his kith and kin, that the wider view of life is shut out from him, and the great purpose for which he exists is either denied or forgotten by him. So that's an excerpt of what Papa describes in the first chapter. So what I would like for this first chapter, if you wouldn't mind, Joe. You print it on both sides, so you get to see it from both sides. Arjuna. So I welcome you to take any theme that kind of draws you, but this is one that you may like to work with for this month. And what did they? That's the first question that Dhritarashtra asks of Sanjay. A fundamental key to growth, both psychologically and spiritually, is your ability to reflect dispassionately on your own experience. Without this ability, you will not be able to perceive accurately what you have thought, said, or done. You will also not be able to have access to deeper intuitional insight. Therefore, the first question coming from the sense mind, Dhritarashtra, to the impartial introspection, to Sanjay, is the most fundamental lesson of the first verse, even of the Gita itself. To cultivate this impartial introspection, you must habituate yourself to observing your interior and exterior life with an impartial view. Each day you should assess how the day went. What did they? Make it a habit at the end of each day, for this coming month, to make a daily inventory of your experience. Be sure to be on the alert for excuse making. Oh, I was just tired, that's why I spoke that way. Or if that person had not treated me this way, I would not have yelled at them. Be impartial, even ruthless, in your assessment of yourself. So number one, how went the day? You may like to keep a journal of this daily introspection. Number two, how does holding yourself accountable in this way subtly change how you act and react as the month proceeds? Number three, what else do you notice in regard to this regular kind of self-assessment? Number four, what characters of the Gita show themselves in and around you?